You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Katie Palmer. John and Katie Palmer would be out for a morning walk in their neighborhood enjoying time together before starting their day. As they were heading back home, John and Katie would be struck from behind by a vehicle that crossed over to the other side of the road. Katie would be killed while John survived. And now John spends every single day fighting for Katie's justice when everything about this horrific accident points to one person being responsible. Yet they still walk free with no consequence. Katie Erin Palmer was born May 3, 1981. She would grow up in Denison, Texas, which is located around 75 miles north of Dallas, with a current population sitting around 22,000 people. Katie was adored by her family and her community and was an amazing athlete. After high school, Katie would attend Austin College, where she would meet and fall in love with her husband, John. In 2008, after John got out of the military, they would move to Denison, Texas, because Katie loved where she grew up, and her mom, Rhonda, still lived in Denison. It would be Katie that decided that for them, that Denison was going to be where they moved and raised their family. That's what John loved about her. She loved her family, and when she made up her mind about something, she just did it. Like buying them a house in Denison and telling John, hey, this is where we're going to go. John and Katie would go on to have two children, Bella and Brandon. Katie has a large family, and family has always been the most important thing to Katie, and she wanted nothing more than to be close to her family. Her mother, Rhonda, was her best friend. Katie absolutely loved the outdoors, and she really enjoyed nature and science. She couldn't stand to just sit indoors and wanted to be outside in nature as much as possible. Katie took that love for nature and science and became a science teacher. And she was so beyond loved by her students, and even today, that love of teaching and how much she cared for her students has stuck with them. Katie taught at Scott Middle School, and just teaching her students wasn't enough. She was responsible for actually establishing a STEM program for her students. It was a robotics club, and Katie was even able to take them to a few competitions in Dallas. She was even lucky enough to get to have her own daughter, Bella, in her robotics class and take her to a competition in Dallas. Katie was an incredible teacher that loved her job, and that was so obvious by how much the children she taught loved her. What made Katie stand out as a teacher was that she didn't just have this genuine love for teaching her students, but she had an incredible thirst for knowledge. And she felt like every time she taught her students something, that she too would learn something new in those lessons. Katie didn't just look at her classroom of kids coming in every year as another set of kids just to teach. She really made it her mission to connect with each one of her students, because not only did she love the subject she was teaching, but she really loved her students, and that was evident in the students whose lives that she has had such an impact on. John and I were able to connect before I started writing this episode, and I am so grateful that he reached out, because when you talk to John, you understand when he says that Katie was their rock. You can hear the incredible respect and love that he has for Katie when he speaks about her. They were married 16 years, and I truly believe they were each other's best friends. John himself will tell you they were soulmates, and I promise you, 2 minutes talking to John and you know they really were soulmates. There's not enough good things I could say about John and the incredible fight that he has taken on for Katie, not just for Katie, but to change things in his community and in his state to make sure that the tragedy that happened to their family doesn't happen to another, and if it does, that it's handled the right way. I'm going to tell you about a series of events that took place on the early morning of April 21st, 2020. However, I urge you to go listen to John tell it in his own words as well. Sarah Turney did an incredible interview with John, and I will be putting a link in the show notes on my webpage that you can click and will take you straight to Sarah's podcast, Voices for Justice. She does an incredible job, as always, at being able to listen to John not just talk about how much he loves Katie, but everything that they've taken on since losing her. It really touches your heart, so please, after you listen to this episode, if you have not heard Katie Palmer's episode on Voices for Justice, please go listen to it. April 21st, 2020, John got up early like he typically does, and he went out to the backyard and did his workout. The night prior, John and Katie were talking, and she had actually asked him to wake her up in the morning so she could join him for his walk. He said he kind of just rolled his eyes because that's not her. She's not the one to get up early in the morning, but he said he would wake her up. Around 7:15 a.m., he texts her phone asking her if she wants to go for a walk and doesn't hear anything, so he continues with his workout. After John finishes working out, he's getting ready to go for his walk when he went back in the house and decided he would go wake up Katie. When he first wakes up Katie, she was not having it. She was not going to do it. She was just going to go back to sleep. But John reminded her that she told him that they wanted to go, and he said, "Come on, let's go." And she gave in and said okay. Katie got ready and John went to tell their son, Brandon, that him and Katie were going on their morning walk together. Typically, Brandon would go on these walks with John in the morning, but Brandon would go back to bed and John and Katie would head out the front door to enjoy an early morning walk in their neighborhood. There is a golf course in the neighborhood very close to their house, and that's the direction in which they headed. John and Katie would start out on their street, Glenwood Drive, heading towards the golf course. When they got to the golf course around 7:50 a.m., they would decide to continue heading west towards some undeveloped plots and a housing development called Golf Walk Circle. The golf course at this time had a lot of dew on it, and Katie didn't want to get her legs wet walking through that because she did plan to go back to sleep for a little bit before having to get up and teach. So they decided to head to the housing development where there had been some killdeer birds nesting. And that was one of Katie's favorite birds, so she wanted to see if they could spot any. Katie had studied ornithology in college. When Katie and John arrived, they would look over the empty plots but didn't see any killdeer out, and John asked Katie if she wanted to stay and look for some more. But at this point, she said no, she was ready to head back home. Katie was going to try to get some more rest before she needed to sign in online to teach her kids virtually. At this point, it was very early on in the pandemic, and every teacher was home virtually teaching their classes, and she had some time before she had to start her morning. I'm going to try to describe their neighborhood and the scenery for you a bit, but I also recommend going to the Justice for Katie Palmer Facebook page where you'll find a video from the body cam footage, as well as a video from dash cam footage showing what it would be like to be the driver driving down this very road. There's no sidewalks. It's truly a lot like where I live. We don't have sidewalks, but we have plenty of space and grassy knolls to walk along, and my neighbors and the people in our community know we're walking, and they drive with caution. They're always looking out because we live in such an active community. We have bikers, children playing, and lots of couples and families out for walks. That being said, it seems like John and Katie's community was the same way. Like John said, he always got up and walked almost every morning, and his son would come with him. This wasn't something new to his neighbors. It wasn't like they didn't know there could be people walking down the street. So I just wanted to make that all clear before I proceed. As John and Katie are now heading back to their house, Corey Foster, their neighbor, is in his pickup truck barreling down the road. It happened so fast, but still today, thinking back to that moment, John can remember Katie looking over her left shoulder. She had a smile on her face and was in the middle of saying something when the next thing they remember, John and Katie are flying through the air. A silver Ford F-150 was what John saw as him and Katie were physically thrown so hard by the impact that they were pulled out of their shoes. While John never lost consciousness, he realized after he stopped being forcefully pushed forward that he couldn't walk and couldn't move to a standing position. So he got on his hands and knees and looked over at Katie, who was now propped up on her left elbow, her eyes looking in his direction but past him. He just remembers Katie letting out a moan of pain, but John couldn't get up and walk to her. So he mustered all his strength and he crawled to Katie and laid her on her back. That's when John would hear Corey Foster, his neighbor, saying, "Oh my God, John, I didn't know it was you. I couldn't see," telling John that he was trying to clear off his windshield because he couldn't see. John looked over at Katie and realized she wasn't breathing. He began begging Katie to please breathe, just breathe, and that's when she would finally let out a breath. But her breath quickly became labored. John lay there with Katie as another neighbor stopped to try to help. John continued to beg Katie not to leave him, just hold on as they waited for help to arrive. Again, I cannot convey the emotion and the pain in this moment, and John has already told the story so that the world would know what happened, and I am not going to ask him to do it again. So please, I urge you to go listen to his interview with Sarah Turney. About 10 minutes after being hit, the fire department and EMTs would arrive and start working on life-saving measures for Katie and John. They checked in with John to ask him if he'd been hurt, and he explained that he had. And I will tell you, this moment is what broke me. I worked in an emergency room on the floor, and I have seen so much trauma and grief come through those halls. But seeing John put on a gurney and put in an ambulance separated from his wife, who was now in a field on another gurney being treated by another set of EMTs, and knowing that was the last moment they had together, and that he physically can't get up and go to her because he needs care too, and he has to come home to their children. That broke me. How anybody could be at that scene and see everything that happened and not feel enraged for the injustice that happens next? There is something wrong with your soul if you are not angry about it. John would be taken to the local hospital and admitted into the ICU. And Katie would be taken by helicopter to a hospital in Plano, Texas. Katie's mother, Rhonda, would be notified that John and Katie were in an accident, but wasn't given the full details on either condition. She was just focused on getting to John and Katie's house to her grandchildren to make sure that they were okay and that they knew what was happening. Once Rhonda knew that they were taking Katie to Plano, she and Brandon and Bella would go straight to the hospital to see their mother. Despite doctors and nurses giving it all they had, Katie would pass away at 1 a.m. the following morning, and John would be in an ICU in another hospital an hour away while his children were saying goodbye to their mother. Rhonda would have to say goodbye to her daughter. Not only could John not physically be there to see his wife and tell her goodbye because he was in an ICU unit an hour away getting treatment, but he also wasn't able to be there for his children to support them, not only saying goodbye to their mother, but to be there for them when they discovered everything that was happening. And every single parent listening right now knows there is nothing like the pain knowing your child is hurt emotionally or physically and not being able to be there for them. That will never leave you. That will always be a scar on your heart. So let's go back to the scene now because we need to discuss who Corey Foster is and what happened when officers arrived. John and Katie were walking on the side of the road with oncoming traffic when they were struck from behind. Corey, who was driving the truck, had swerved across the road to the other side, striking Katie and John. Corey would come to a rolling stop after striking Katie and John. Based on cell phone records, we can see that Corey had just started calling someone and had just connected when Corey struck them. Corey would end that call after he realized that he struck his neighbors and would call 911. We will touch more on those cell phone records in a little bit. We know what happened when the officer arrives because of the body cam footage. It would be Trooper Tariff Alkatib that would arrive on scene and speak with Corey. The reason that I don't play the audio, and I believe a lot of other podcasts won't play the audio, is because it's very hard to hear. A helicopter has arrived for Katie to take her to the trauma unit an hour away. If you are interested in seeing some of the body cam footage, you can definitely head over to Justice for Katie Palmer's Facebook page because John has posted some of the footage there. So because the audio is so hard to hear with the helicopter, I'm going to walk you through what happened when Trooper Al-Khatib arrived at the scene. Trooper Al-Khatib exits his vehicle and checks with the EMT and firefighters standing at their cruiser next to Corey Foster's truck. When they arrive, Corey is already out of his truck. In fact, you'll see on the body cam footage that Corey is standing at the tail end of his truck. Al-Khatib will proceed past Corey and head to the ambulance to speak to John first. John explains to Trooper Al-Khatib what side of the road they were on, which direction they were heading when they would get hit, and John would tell the trooper that Corey says he didn't see them because he was cleaning his windshield, but even John at this moment questions why he was on the other side of the road and mentions that he was going too fast. When Al-Khatib approaches Corey, he's at the back of his truck standing with two other people. Al-Khatib asks him to come speak to him, and he kind of directs him towards the front of the truck. Al-Khatib asks him for his insurance, registration, basic information. At this point, Al-Khatib says, "We're going to get this truck locked because we don't want anybody else going in and out of it." He has Corey follow him to his cruiser to continue questioning him. Officer Al-Khatib asks him what happened, and Corey Foster replies, "Well, I was leaving the house to get a couple of guys. They were going to help me do some work today, and I was just clearing my windshield. It was foggy, and I couldn't see because of the glare. It was so bad." Al-Khatib replies, "Yeah." Corey goes on to say, "Which I shouldn't have driven. I should have waited at the house." At this point, Al-Khatib goes on to ask him what side of the road Katie and John were walking on, to which Corey replies he doesn't know because he doesn't even know he hit them. He thought he had hit a telephone pole. Corey then goes on to explain that he moved his truck so it would be out of the way so that the ambulance could get in. The very next question Al-Khatib has, he looks Corey right in the face and says, "Corey, how much have you had to drink?" He says he can smell the alcohol, to which Corey replies, "I had a couple of whiskeys last night around 6 or 7 p.m. and went to bed early." Corey goes on to explain that his daughter had a fever, so he's been up and down all night. And Al-Khatib says, "Well, I can smell it pretty strong today. So how late were you up and how much were you drinking?" Al-Khatib asks him, "Over the entire day yesterday, how many drinks do you think you probably had?" And Corey replies, 4 or 5. Al-Khatib goes on to ask Corey if he takes medication, which he does, but I'm not going to discuss. It's personal information. However, the drugs he is taking, at least the ones he mentions, would not cause any known impairment. At this point, Al-Khatib goes on and asks Corey to follow him to do some field sobriety tests. However, this field sobriety test is now being performed close to an hour after officials arrive on the scene. First, he has Corey do the standard walking in a straight line test. He would perform the horizontal gaze test with him as well. Officer Al-Khatib assures Corey that he's doing this just as much for his protection as anything else. He tells Corey he wants to be able to rule out that he's intoxicated. Al-Khatib has another test for Corey. He asks Corey to do the balance test where you put out both your arms straight and stand on one foot and count to 30 seconds. This we can see much clearer, and we can see Corey struggling. In fact, he doesn't last the full 30 seconds. And at that point, it looks like Al-Khatib doesn't even hesitate to walk away while speaking to Corey to open the passenger side of his cruiser, open the glove compartment, and grab the breathalyzer. Right when Corey sees the breathalyzer, he tells Al-Khatib that he's struggling because his work boots aren't level. Al-Khatib says he'll take that into consideration and asks him to blow into the breathalyzer. Officer Al-Khatib does not show the body cam the reading of the breathalyzer, but does look at Corey and says, "You must have drank a lot last night because it's still going up." The fact that the only record of the breathalyzer test is what number Officer Al-Khatib wrote down, and there's no visual of the number of the breathalyzer to confirm, leaves us with no choice but to go off the one documented instance of that number, which states that Corey was under the legal limit at 0.06. Officer Al-Khatib tells Corey that he's going to have to tow his vehicle and they're at least going to have it overnight, so he'll need a ride home. Now, before Corey leaves the scene, Officer Al-Khatib does walk him to his truck and asks him if there's anything he would like to get out of the truck. In the center console, there seems to be a drink container, and Al-Khatib shows some interest in it, but it quickly goes into Corey's hands and the conversation shifts. Corey does explain that he has two loaded pistols that he would like to get out, which Officer Al-Khatib just opens the door and allows him to grab those two loaded pistols, while allowing Corey to unload them in the back seat before securing them. And the whole time this is happening, Al-Khatib's back is turned towards Corey. Al-Khatib also asks Corey if there's anything else he needs, and it looks like Corey grabs some mail and that cup from the center console. It would be Officer Al-Khatib that gives Corey and his pistols a ride home, and once Corey gets into Al-Khatib's car in the front passenger seat and he enters the driver's seat, he shuts off the body cam and the dash cam. And I just want to point out that Corey gets into Al-Khatib's cruiser in the front without being told to do this. The fact that he feels comfortable enough in that moment just to open the passenger door and place himself in the front seat says a lot. Since when do we put suspects in the cruiser and turn off both of our cameras? And since when do we give suspects a ride home? Now, before Corey gets in the cruiser with Al-Khatib, it's very important that I point out to you that Corey tells Officer Al-Khatib that his mother could give him a ride home. But Officer Al-Khatib tells Corey to tell your mom everything's okay. Why he didn't let Corey and his mom just go and his mom drive him home because she was already there, I don't really understand that interaction. But I'm doing my very best not to speculate. There's so much more to this video, and there's so many moments that when you're watching it, I feel are super important. And truly, you need to head to the Justice for Katie Facebook page and watch every clip that you can, because I think it's important for everyone to see exactly how this was handled. And every conversation and every moment is super important. Important things that need to be noted here, beginning with first responders are usually questioned at the scene, like, what did you see when you arrived? That didn't happen. When you have a motor vehicle accident, you usually have someone that comes to the scene and they mark the scene and take pictures of it so that it can be recreated again for a jury if needed. And that didn't happen in the way that it should have. The proper amount of pictures were not taken, period. There were eyewitnesses that say they saw the accident and they weren't questioned. From the jump, this whole investigation is mishandled. And that would be just the beginning of the hell that Katie's loved ones have been through in the fight for her justice. So let's talk about Corey Foster. Why was he driven home by an officer instead of being driven to the hospital to get a blood test? Something that me and John spoke about that I totally didn't think about at the time was when he arrived to the ICU and Katie arrived at the trauma center, you know they drew their blood. That is what is typically standard when you go through ICU or trauma. Pretty much, if you're coming into the emergency room through an ambulance, you're going to get blood work done. However, something I didn't think about was they can always look at Katie and John's blood work and see they were not intoxicated and they didn't have drugs in their system, but we don't have any blood work on the driver that struck them. Why wasn't that done? Why wasn't he taken to the hospital at all after being in an accident? In fact, another officer on the scene does ask Officer Al-Khatib if they're going to test Corey Foster's blood before they tow away Corey's vehicle. And Officer Al-Khatib tells him no. In fact, around 2 or 3 days later, after John gets home, Officer Al-Khatib will tell John that he did him a favor by not asking Corey to take a blood test, telling John that the breathalyzer is where they had Corey. If he had taken a blood test, it would have dropped to a lower percentage, like 0.03 or lower, and that's the result you would have been stuck with. John at the time even thanked Officer Al-Khatib for doing that because from what he understood was if the blood work really was that low, then it would alter the breathalyzer results in a negative way. There are lots of great articles you can read about the difference between the breathalyzer and the blood test and just how alcohol metabolizes in your body and how we generally do blood tests. You would definitely think that that would have been logically the next step, but that wasn't taken. And the fact that Al-Khatib went out of his way to tell this to John is just not okay. Something that's also very important that I take the time to mention here is that Officer Al-Khatib and Corey Foster do personally know each other. Nobody's saying that they're best friends, that they hang out all day, every day, but there is the fact that they do know each other. Al-Khatib's wife and Corey Foster's wife were good friends, and there are multiple pictures of those two together. So to say that Corey and Al-Khatib never crossed paths isn't right. The fact is they do know each other, and they have had interactions with one another outside of this whole incident. At that point, I do believe that Officer Al-Khatib should have called in another officer to take the lead on the investigation, because they do know each other outside of all this. Even if it's just their wives or really good friends that used to work together, still, as an officer, your responsibility is to say, hey, I know this guy, his wife and my wife are friends. Maybe I shouldn't be the one that is questioning him. We do know at some point Al-Khatib's wife and Corey Foster's wife did work together before. That being said, that is enough for you as an officer to say that you're too close to this person to be able to be the lead on the scene. That would have been the honorable and respectable thing to do, period. Now, of course, there's an incident report which is written up by Al-Khatib, and in that report, he states that he believes that alcohol may or may not be the leading cause for this accident, as well as driving on the wrong side of the road. Al-Khatib also keeps saying it was foggy, and that is something when I spoke with John that I wanted to clear up. I'm glad we had a moment to speak about it. John said it's not foggy in the way that we're all thinking. So I was thinking foggy in the sense of there's a thick white fog on the ground in the morning because of the dew and the grass across the fields, and it usually goes across the road. At least that's how it works around here on a foggy day. And so in my head, that's what I pictured. But that's not what was happening here. They keep saying foggy, and what they mean by foggy is their windshields were getting fogged up because of the condensation on the windshields, and the wiper blades were supposedly not keeping up with the ability to wipe away the fog. So I just want to make it clear that it was not a foggy day, as in there was mist and fog on the ground causing people not to see what was in front of them. That's something that Al-Khatib mentions in his incident report, that it was foggy, and again, it's a simple word without context, which I believe was needed in the situation and will make you picture the scene completely different. Now, Al-Khatib goes on to describe in his incident report that a prudent person should have stopped to make sure that their windshield was clear and that they could see before proceeding, and knowing he couldn't see what he was approaching or what was approaching him was clear negligence on his part. So in the incident report, let's just quickly summarize. Al-Khatib says there are factors that Corey was aware of that would make him negligent for the accident. There is a discrepancy in his report, however. Al-Khatib says that Corey lost his balance at 27 seconds, but if you go back and watch the video, he loses his balance at 19 seconds. And Al-Khatib starts walking right away to his cruiser to get a breathalyzer. At this point, we have Corey Foster himself, who admitted multiple times on the body cam footage that he couldn't see. We also have Corey in the body cam footage talking to Officer Al-Khatib and explaining that he was drinking the day before and his drinks are multiplying and the time of consumption is changing throughout him explaining what he consumed. We also have the fact that Corey was driving on the wrong side of the road and he struck Katie and John, and Katie and John were struck so hard they were physically flown out of their shoes 70 feet, which means he was going much faster than he should have been going down the road. With all this information in front of you, most rational, logical thinkers would say this is going to be an open-shut case. We know enough information to say that Corey Foster was responsible for the injuries to John and the death of Katie. We know that the charges and court hearings and logistics of all that takes time. But right now, with all the information in front of you, it seems like it's going to be an open-shut case. However, that's not what happened. It just gets more messy and frustrating from here. It would be August 19th, 2020 that the case for charges against Corey of manslaughter or criminal negligence would be brought in front of a grand jury. This case would be presented to the grand jury by Grayson County First Assistant District Attorney Carrie Ashmore. The typical jury of the state of Texas would require 12 jurors. However, on August 19th, 2020, Carrie Ashmore would proceed to present this case to only 10 jurors. The reason for it being 10 jurors is stated that one called out sick and one actually recused themselves. However, they still proceeded with only 10. Now, 9 of those jurors needed to agree to proceed with the charges for this case to go to trial. It would be 3 hours of presentation in which only partial footage from the body cam would be shown, which I've already stated multiple times that it is vital that we watch every minute of the footage. After the 3 hour presentation, there would be 1 hour of deliberation in which the jury decided not to move forward with charges for Corey. Shortly after this, it would come out that one of the jurors was also friends with the assistant DA, and there would be pictures of them hanging out at a pool party together at the assistant DA's house on Facebook, just a few days after the trial. Again, we know it's a small town, but now we have a connection with Corey and the trooper Alcatib outside of the accident showing some form of relationship, especially in the case of an officer that turns his back to a man unloading pistols in the backseat of a truck who he just breathalyzed and keeps telling him that he smells alcohol on him. We can safely assume that Alcatib and Corey have some kind of relationship, but now we also have a juror who has a personal relationship with the assistant DA. So many miscarriages of justice are happening from the very start. Carrie Ashmore would be interviewed by KWTX 10 News about the grand jury presentation and the jury's decision not to indict Corey, saying, quote, "The grand jury was provided all the information we had during the 3 hours of testimony, including testimony from the expert we hired and deliberated for an hour. They obviously worked hard on this case and struggled with the decisions of whether the facts rose to the level of criminal negligence. That is an enormous responsibility. This is a tragic, horrible incident. I cannot imagine the pain that John and his family have endured. Our hearts go out to them." End quote. 6 days after the hearing, an independent crash report would be released that never was presented to the jury, as well as no phone records were presented to the jury either to show that Corey was on the phone during the accident, which again shows another piece of negligence on his part. In saying that the grand jury was provided with all the information when you don't show the entire body cam footage, I'm not sure how those two statements can correlate. John would eventually acquire these records, but like I told you from the beginning, we know that Corey was on the phone, but those records do indicate that he was on a call about 31 seconds before striking Katie and John. And there are 2 second gap between the call ending and the call to 911 beginning. None of this information was available at the time that they held the first hearing and definitely paints a bigger picture for the jury of what was happening at the time. How can you deliberate on something when you don't have all the pieces presented to you? John will tell you he believes the phone records point to Corey driving, initiating a call in his hand, and then Corey himself tells officers that he's using his hand to wipe away the fog. So, no hands on the steering wheel? Would that account for why he was on the other side of the road? And that's without even talking about the possible level of impairment, because again, almost an hour before he is given a breathalyzer. And we have no blood work from Corey from that day to analyze. Despite this blow to their fight for Katie, this does not stop John and Rhonda and all the people that love Katie. They keep pushing forward. They don't just push forward for Katie. They continue to push forward for those in their community and their state for this to never happen again. September 1st, 2021, Colton's Law took effect in Texas. I will, of course, link articles about Colton's Law and about Colton Carney, who this law is named after. In January 2017, Colton was on his way to work when he was struck and killed by a motorist in Roy City, Texas. Colton's family would learn that Colton's blood was tested for drugs and alcohol, but the person who struck him with a vehicle taking his life was not tested for the presence of drugs or alcohol. The current law in 2017 and when Katie and John were hit stated that it was up to individual law enforcement officers to decide whether or not to conduct blood alcohol tests on a motorist when they hit pedestrian. So that decision has been left to a responding officer at the scene, not first responders that are medically trained. Colton's mother, Michelle, and his father, Dwayne, would spend the next 4 years reaching out to state representatives, asking them to introduce legislation that would require blood and alcohol testing if a motorist was to strike a pedestrian that caused serious injury or death. I find that a perfectly reasonable request, and I'm genuinely shocked to find out the decision is left with the officers that arrive on scene. Colton's mother, Michelle, would tell the Herald Banner in 2018, quote, It makes no sense to us that they would test our son, but not the man who killed him. Even if it was only an accident, we don't know if he was texting, if he was on a new prescription that affected him adversely, if he was a functioning alcoholic or anything else. We just don't know. End quote. In January 2021, State Representative Terry Meza filed a bill named Colton's Law, which, if passed, would empower police officers to detain someone who has hit a pedestrian to test for the presence of drugs or alcohol in their system. At the press conference at the Texas State Capitol, Representative Meza would say, quote, "Anyone who hits a pedestrian in the state causing serious bodily injury or death should not be allowed to leave the scene of the accident without having been tested for the presence of drugs or alcohol in their body," end quote. John Palmer, his family, and all his amazing supporters would rally behind Colton's family, calling their supporters to reach out and email and call as many members of the Texas House representatives as possible to get Colton's Law passed. The official name of the bill is HB 558, and with all of them rallying together, September 1st of 2021, that bill was officially a law on the books in Texas. Together, Colton's family and Katie's loved ones are making huge strides to protect anyone else from experiencing what they had to deal with after losing their loved ones to these tragic accidents. Colton Carney's family has done amazing things, and they continue to do amazing things in their community as well. I will link the Colton Carney Memorial Fund Facebook page so that you can learn more about Colton Carney and his case. This bill didn't just create a law, but they put a spotlight on Officer Al-Khatib and how he handled Katie and John's case, a massive spotlight in the state of Texas and in the Senate. I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but I want it to be clear because there's so much information. But John and Katie's loved ones, her family, her friends, her community, they want Trooper Al-Khatib held responsible for his handling of this investigation. They have plenty of things to point to say that he needs to be held accountable for, steps he took when he arrived at that scene, and how they have impacted every second of this case moving forward. At this point, I think I can confidently say that we all agree there needed to be another grand jury trial to present the charges of manslaughter and negligence against Corey, because now there's been enough time for all the evidence to be collected and presented and the correct amount of jurors. Unfortunately, that wouldn't happen. There would be another grand jury trial, but once again, Katie and her family would be let down by the system and those in it. On November 2nd, 2021, John would receive a call at 4:30 p.m. from Carrie Ashmore stating that they were going to re-present the case of manslaughter and negligence against Corey again in front of a grand jury, this time using the cell phone records that John was able to obtain. They would be doing this the very next morning. We all know most government offices and state offices close by 5 p.m., and John receiving this call not only so late in the business day, but he's literally being told that it's going to be presented first thing in the morning. John asks, does he need to be there? To which Ashmore replies, no, I'm just going to present it tomorrow and see if we can move forward. John said they would end the call and it would hit him that this just isn't right. None of this feels right. And he would try to call back Ashmore twice and he would not answer the phone. John was told if you want to get a hold of him, you're going to have to text him. He would let Ashmore know that he has tried to call twice and he still has some questions. And if he had time to talk, he would appreciate him calling him. Ashmore said he was not available to talk, but they did text back and forth that night. I'm going to summarize here, but John asks him how this is going to be presented. Are you going to be presenting just the new piece of evidence with a synopsis to the jury, or are you going to represent the entire body of evidence to this jury, including the new evidence like the phone records and the crash report? John wanted to understand, was it just going to be a small amount of evidence presented to this grand jury and then a full representation to another grand jury? John asked him if he was confident in the strategy. John would remind Ashmore that he wakes up every single day rolling over to expect to see Katie there, and she's not. John would say, quote, I lose her every damn morning over and over again, unquote. I heard John speak those words, and I don't know how Ashmore perceived those words, but anyone with a significant other or a loved one that they live with that they see every day can understand the pain in that statement and can feel it. Ashmore does respond that the presentation will be the new evidence and a summary, and they will answer any question the jury has, and then the jury will decide whether to pursue or not. So again, they're not presenting the entire body of evidence to the jury. John would go on to tell Ashmore that, again, he is asking that this case be presented to a full jury in its entirety. And something we need, again, to talk about is John was never given a straight answer about what happened to the alternates on the original 10-person jury. We still have no straight answer on why there were no alternates put in at that time. So you can understand that John and his family are frustrated. Now he's being told the phone records that John acquired himself, those are now going to be presented, along with the crash report, and that they were going to do a synopsis of what happened and then answered some questions and then let the jury deliberate. But at least you're getting 12 jurors this time. And also, this time, they're not allowing John to testify, which he has every right to do. John would tell Ashmore that together with his testimony and the new evidence presented in its entirety, that they could get Corey indicted for taking away Katie's life. But Ashmore stopped responding. So John would call Brett Smith around 6 a.m. the following morning, leaving him a message. Brett Smith is the district attorney. John would let Smith know that he would be there in the morning and that he wanted to talk to him before the assistant DA Ashmore presented this case again to another grand jury. John and Katie's mother, Rhonda, showed up at 7:45 a.m. and sat and waited to be seen, but neither Ashmore or Smith came out to speak to them. Ashmore would go ahead and present the new evidence to the jury around 8:15 a.m., and after the trial, Ashmore would walk out, look at John and his family, and say, well, it's in the jury's hands now. John asked Ashmore why he would not let us do anything, and he looked at Rhonda and John and said, this is the way we're doing it now. Ashmore would look at Rhonda and tell her that he didn't owe her an explanation, that he was damn good at his job and he didn't appreciate John questioning him. Ashmore would come back and let them know that the grand jury didn't want to move forward, and John said that is when he lost it. He began cussing him up and down, and since they are in the same building as the sheriff's department, sheriff deputies were popping out of the hallway because there was all this loud commotion happening. But John had held it together for so long, and Ashmore wasn't giving his family the compassion and understanding, especially in that moment, that they deserved. Ashmore would retreat to his office, but what I think John wants people to understand most is that he was taking out his frustration on someone they feel has done everything they can do to prevent them from getting justice for Katie. John really feels at this point something went wrong for Ashmore when it comes to prosecuting these cases. They definitely feel like this is because they demanded answers in the beginning, and they rallied against the district attorney's department saying, hey, what are you doing? Why is this taking so long? These are the things you should be doing. But now this isn't about getting Katie justice. It's about showing everyone what happens when you stand up to the good old boys club. I find it interesting that both John and I have used that term. And it was the first thing I thought when researching everything, and I told John when I spoke with him, that is how I felt after reading about this case. The first thing that comes to mind when you're researching this case, if you've been paying attention, it seems like everyone who's in a position to help bring Katie justice is more focused on having their buddies back, and it has become more about protecting their buddies than getting Katie the justice she deserves. And if I'm wrong, I would love for them to prove me wrong. Ashmore, in separate phone calls to both Rhonda and John when talking about prosecuting Katie's case, has told them both the same quote. Quote, you go against the boss, you go against the house. End quote. You all know I don't speculate. I do everything I can not to speculate. So I don't think saying that this is the old boys club that needs to be broken up and held accountable is speculation. I think from everything I've researched, My interview with John, everything I've watched, everything I've listened to, everything I've read, everything I've heard makes me stand by that statement. What I was telling John is I truly feel like it is a clear statement to John and his family that if you want to keep pushing me, I can make this worse for you. When did this become about that whole department's ego over what's right? John is doing his part already to clean house and break up the good old boys club. He is demanding change and he is making it happen. A county judge, Bill Majors, that about 2 months before Katie was killed, was arrested for his fourth DWI. When Bill Majors took a breathalyzer on his fourth DWI, he was 3 times over the legal limit. He had hit a telephone pole, then fled the scene of the accident and would be crossing over lanes on the highway, being pursued by officers, and would finally be pulled over by a state trooper and a Sherman police officer. All of this, by the way, the full incident is captured on camera. As can be seen on camera, Bill Majors is about to be arrested for his fourth DWI and all this chaos that he just caused. As he's being handcuffed and being placed into the trooper's vehicle, the state trooper walks to get Bill Majors' cell phone to bring it to him. And that's when they would realize that Bill Majors had just missed a call from no other than his friend, Brett Smith, the district attorney. So that leads us to believe that while Bill Majors has done this whole hit and run, and before he gets stopped, he's calling his buddy to come bail him out. This enrages John, and it should enrage every citizen in his county. The fact that we're talking about his fourth DWI and he was still a sitting county judge when he received that fourth DWI is completely beyond me. John would step up and use his platform on Facebook to call attention to this, and the media picked it up and they ran with it, as they should have. People in his county need to know the truth of what is happening. And I do have a clip from that press conference that I'm going to play for you guys, because John brought attention to this and was able to get that judge unseated on the next election. That's huge.
We lost Katie. Katie was a wife, a mother, and a daughter. Katie was hit and killed by a reckless and impaired driver with a 30-year record that has never been held accountable. The same can be said for our current county judge, Bill Majors. Judge Majors has a 30-year record that includes multiple DWI arrests, once as a mayor of Sherman, and now one as a Grayson County judge, and at least 2 DWI convictions. His latest arrest and conviction for last year, here in this parking lot. The pole that he hit could have been your wife, your mother, or your daughter. It's completely unacceptable. During Bill Majors' last DWI arrest, law enforcement found that Majors missed a call from District Attorney Brett Smith, the same DA who failed to get justice for my wife. It appears that Bill Majors reached out to his friend in a last-ditch effort to escape accountability yet again. And once again, Majors received only a slap on the wrist despite his multiple DWI arrests. This slap on the wrist is a slap in the face to my family and other families like ours who have lost a loved one due to reckless and impaired driving. These continued DWI arrests are not acceptable and show a pattern. Our county deserves better. Our county needs major change, and it needs to start at the top. Since Katie's death, our family has fought for justice for her and has fought for change in Grayson County and statewide. We have made it our mission to hold lifetime drunk drivers accountable and have worked with lawmakers in Austin on these changes. Bill Majors is not the only public official to abuse his office across Texas. Time and time again, we see public officials who believe that they are above the law. Fortunately, our lawmakers understand this and made it possible for ordinary citizens like me and you to remove these corrupt officials from office. Which is why today I filed a petition and lawsuit with the district clerk's office under Chapter 87 of the State of Texas Local Government Code, requesting that Judge Bill Majors be removed from office to his latest DWI arrest, in which he was 3 times over the limit, and for his apparent attempt and obstructing justice by calling his friend, District Attorney Brett Smith, for assistance prior to being arrested for yet another DWI. We all talk about the good old boy system. What that term refers to is when judges, district attorneys, and commissioners are such good friends that they allow each other and those close to them to commit crimes without consequences. This county needs to stop looking the other way when men like Majors continually break the law and continue to not be held accountable. Now listen, I believe in second chances. I do. But where do we draw the line? Do we wait until Judge Majors hits somebody instead of a pole? Do we wait until his fifth or sixth DWI? Does Grayson County have a district judge that will grant this petition and enforce the law? But better yet, can District Attorney Brett Smith put aside his friendship and political allegiance to Judge Majors, pick a jury, and take this to trial? Or will he refuse to personally prosecute him the way he did when Majors picked up his latest arrest? This county needs change. This county needs a leader that is fit to lead and one that is not a liability. Bill Majors, it's time for you to step down. Thank you.
And that's how you break down the good old boys club, piece by piece. I wanted to play that clip for a few reasons. I wanted you to understand what John's intention was with pursuing the lawsuit, and even though it was chaotic and messy, and again, the cards were stacked against John, this time he got to stand up and tell someone that was elected to protect and serve his community that they have been doing wrong. At the very least, he got to hold them accountable for that. Secondly, I just wanted you to hear John's voice and the passion in his fight. I tried to tell John how incredible I think he is for not only fighting for Katie's justice, but for his neighbors, his community, for his state, for things to change so no family faces this. John is very humble and gracious, but I just want him to know that we see him. We see how hard he and so many that love Katie are working. To be able to take that amount of grief and pain and anger and turn it into such good work and good things, I would just like everybody to take a moment to put yourself in his shoes, in Rhonda's shoes, and understand the pain that they're in and that they were able to muster the strength to fight, even when continuously feeling like the deck is stacked. And for John and Rhonda's sake, and for everyone that loved Katie, Brandon, and Bella, it isn't just a feeling. I know you guys will still beat this because you guys have fought so hard. And I know the fight inside of you is not going anywhere. And you're building such an incredible army behind you. I would like to thank John and his family for giving me the opportunity to tell Katie's story. Their story, and everything that they're going through. I want to thank my listeners today. This was a little bit of a longer episode with a lot of information, and I promise you guys, this is just the tip of the massive iceberg that is John and Katie's case, and everything that's gone into it, and every battle that they fought, and every battle ahead of them. And so I ask you to please, once again, go to the Justice for Katie Palmer's Facebook page and follow it, because that is where John is putting every update, every video, every interview, every link, everything that happens in Katie's case is on that page. Please go over and show your love and support. I can't say enough good things about Sarah Turney and her podcast, Voices for Justice. Like I said before, John was able to give Sarah an incredible interview, talking about everything that happened in its own words, and I'm always impressed by the way Sarah covers cases and how she puts her episodes together, because she puts them together from two unique perspectives. That's one as a podcaster and one as a family member of a victim of true crime. With that unique perspective, her interviews and her cases are covered with love and care. If you haven't listened to her podcast, which I would be shocked if you haven't, go over to Apple Podcast or Spotify or any of your favorite podcast players and go download Voices for Justice. I promise you won't regret it. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify, if you can hit that subscribe button, leave a review. That helps other listeners find this podcast and gets cases like these to more ears. Don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit share, like, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.